When I taught medicine, I discovered that if you didn't make students actually practice intellectual integrity, they wouldn't do it. I never used to tell them that they couldn't leave a bedside teaching session until they'd said, "I don't know." Of course, that doesn't last too long. They find out that's the exit phrase and they say it. But it's an important point. It's a pity that many of my colleagues would upbraid them every time they said, "I don't know." It was the wisdom of Socrates, after all. But today's topic is one that's been of interest to me from some time. The whole idea that history should matter to us seems to be foreign to many Christians. Many Protestants behave as though nothing happened from the end of the Acts of the Apostles until the 16th century. That's not true, as you well know. And students think that anything before 1960 can't possibly be of importance, and that also is untrue. So Ockham to Dawkins is a long stretch, and actually I'm going to start a bit further back. Because I'm going to go back to Aristotle. Because I think that what has happened to us over the last 4 or 5 centuries was that we disposed of a rich epistemology and replaced it with a thin one. This fits in very well with what J.P. Moreland was talking about on the first evening. For the ancient world, the idea of causation was important. Why do things happen? Change? What's the nature of it? And the dominant model is called the four causes. They have fancy names. They're called the material, the formal, the efficient, and the final causes, but you don't need to remember those names. I'm much more concerned that you go away with things in your head that stick than that you have fancy words. And all you need to get in your head is, when you're asked about causation, think about a statue. Now, obviously, the material cause of the statue is what it's made out of, the marble, the bronze, whatever it is. The formal cause of the statue is the idea inside the head of the sculptor. Famously, Michelangelo would say that he would liberate from a block of marble what he had already seen in it. The efficient cause, of course, is the skills and the tools that the sculptor uses. And the final cause is the purpose for which the statue was made, which in ancient times was to beautify the city. Now, if there was the verb, in many cases it would be to uglify the city. In fact, in Ottawa, we have one modern sculptor who is deeply disillusioned with the world. And outside the police station, the main police station in Ottawa, a piece of his sculpture is there. And it's all made out of iron, which was chosen to be highly degradable. And it is, every day, it's rusting away a bit more. I mean, what message is he sending outside the police station about the nature of justice? But he's not far wrong, in actual fact. So those were the four causes of the ancient world. And they dominated thinking for a long while. There are many steps in between, but the next one that I want to pick up is Thomas Aquinas's integration of the Christian faith with Aristotelian thought. It was a huge and magnificent piece of intellectual work. Undoubtedly the greatest intellectual feat in several centuries. Interestingly enough, from our point of view particularly, just before he died, a few months before he died, Thomas had a meeting with Jesus in the chapel of the monastery. Another monk was there at the time. Clearly, Thomas saw Jesus, the monk didn't, but he heard two sentences. Christ said to Thomas, "It is well done, Thomas, what do you wish?" And Thomas said, "Only you, O Lord." He never wrote another word. He referred to the greatest intellectual feat in several centuries as mere straw. Now, later on this afternoon, somebody's going to be talking about consciousness. File away that thought about what happened to Thomas. And write down on your notebook so that when you get back home, you think about it. Tacit knowledge. T-A-C-I-T. Because we need to major in tacit knowledge if we're going to redeem the university culture. We need to carve out a legitimate place for it. But I have more to say about that in a moment. But conversion, I think, is a superb example of tacit knowledge. I mustn't digress at this point, but if I miss out, bring me back to this. So Thomas integrated Aristotelian thought and the scripture. Obviously, his love of the Lord is without question, and what he was trying to do was to hold faith and reason together. We've always struggled with this, as again J.P. Morland said last night. And at our end of the spectrum, our danger is always to fall into faith without reason. It's just as easy to fall into reason without faith. They have got to be constantly held in tension, the two wings upon which the church flies. When Thomas had completed his work, the church, in fact, the Catholic Church, was worried about it. As we also worry about intellectuals and what they might do to our children, and rightly so, because they do a lot of damage. The church worried about that. They worried that the teachings of Thomas Aquinas might lead some of the faithful astray. So in 1277, the Bishop of Paris actually banned the teaching of Thomas Aquinas. That's just a few years after his death. The ban didn't last very long, and in their usual devious fashion, the Brits in Oxford managed to avoid the ban, which really annoyed the academics in Paris, who, being all monks, of course, had to obey the bishop's orders. And you can easily imagine what it felt like. It's rather as though you went back to school in August and found that the dean had said, you can't teach the courses you taught last year, you have to start from scratch. It would not be a pleasant summer, would it? I imagine they all went to the pub and drowned their sorrows, so to speak, for a little while. And then, this is pure artistic license, but I think there's probably some truth to it. I think someone said something like this. We have now recaptured, or until it was banned, and we still have recaptured even though it's banned, deductive Aristotelian logic. And that's a powerful tool. And they all wanted to teach it, but it was forbidden. But what wasn't forbidden was inductive reasoning. Now, Aristotle knew about inductive reasoning, but he never used it because he didn't trust it. He thought the world tended where everything was moving to its rightful place. So an experiment, as we understand it, would only teach you pathology because you were stopping things going to their rightful place by the experiment, and he wasn't interested in pathology at that point. So, although he knew about inductive reasoning, he didn't trust it. But in the 13th century, they started teaching it. And the argument, I think, went something like this. In Genesis, God had taught us that we should have power over nature. The power of stewardship, not ownership, but power. And we have precious little. All these centuries have passed, and our crops still apparently fail at random. Accidents happen all the while, we have little control over disease, etc., etc. Perhaps it's because our puny human minds are not capable of going from God to the particulars of everyday life. Maybe we should reverse the process. Maybe we should start with particulars that we can study and work back the other way. This is the beginning of experiment. It began in both Paris and Oxford. With Oresme in Paris and the Merton School in Oxford. And it led in a couple of centuries. The graph was invented and nobody knew what they'd invented. What we teach in the first two or three years at school took two or three centuries to work out. Well, not three, but over a century. And then Galileo started rolling a ball down an inclined plane and changing the angle and measuring where the ball hit the ground. He had no idea that that would put a man on the moon. Eventually, but it did. Or at least the extrapolations from that. Inductive reasoning worked. Experiment worked. Now, the bottom line for us and the thing that we must always get to, I give a talk called If Newton Had Not Had His God, He Would Not Have Gone Looking for His Laws. You see, nobody would believe inductive reasoning if they didn't believe there was a God of order underneath the surface chaos of life. An animist doesn't believe there's any order. They really believe that it's chaos. And it's controlled by local evil spirits. And for that reason, there's never been a nutrition education program in sub-Saharan Africa that worked if you remove all expatriate input for two or three years before you evaluate. The Jewish tradition is what led us to understand that God was a God of order. And it was buried deep in our psyche, but it was there, ready to go. The Jewish tradition had also, if you've noticed this, there are two things in Genesis 1 that don't get the accolade, and it was good. One is the heavens and the other is us. Well, us is easy to understand. It's called sin. The heavens, well, it made the big difference between the Jewish creation stories and all others. God was saying, the heavens are just something I made. They're not sacred, so science was possible. If the heavens are sacred, science would be sacrilege. So the Jews, Orthodox Jews, understand that God put right back in Genesis the possibility of science. And the God of order, inductive reasoning, was also possible. So you need to master that argument, and you need to learn the rhetoric of how to make the point to your students. When I tell my students that Kepler wrote prayers in his lab book, they are embarrassed. But he did. And he recalculated by hand for 5 or 6 years Tycho Brahe's data on the orbit of Mars, because for the first time, Tycho Brahe was the first person who knew the limits of his data. In other words, he knew that what he measured was not the truth, but he knew how close an approximation it was. He was the first person to think in those kinds of terms. So Copernicus didn't have access to data that was that good. Kepler did. So he wrote in his lab book a prayer giving thanks for an error, I think of it was a 5 minutes of arc in the movement of Mars, because that's what led to the ellipse. That's what led to Kepler's laws. 5 years by hand, recalculating the data. And then the ellipse, he doesn't know where it came from. It's one of those God things, and he knew it. No computer would do that sort of thing in the same way, unless it was programmed to do it, of course, in which case that's not where the genius lies. But that's what happened. So very swiftly, in a period of about a century or so, Newton was born in the year that Galileo died. And Newton was also born on Christmas Day, and that was important to him as well. He thought he had a divine hand on him. And certainly in terms of the history of science, I don't think anyone has equaled Newton as a single individual performer. Einstein comes close. But those four men, all of whom believed in God, gave us what, within a century, became a tacitly atheistic universe. So that within about 100 years of Newton, you have Laplace, the French physicist, saying to Napoleon, when asked where God fitted in his science, he said, "Sir, I have no need of the hypothesis of God." And of course, he was right. Once inductive reasoning and the experimental method had been shown to work empirically, you didn't need to believe in God to use it. But it's intellectually dishonest not to acknowledge that it was essential to somebody using it in the first place, being willing to use that much time and effort for that kind of idea. So, 50 years ago even, there would be many historians of science who said that there's been a war between science and faith. Now I would think in the top rank of historians of science, there are very few who would say that. If you want a really good introduction to the history of science, the beginnings of science, read David Lindbergh's book, The Beginnings of Western Science, from the University of Chicago Press, and pray for him as you read it, because he's on his way to faith, but he's not there yet. But he's very honest about the role that the Christian faith played. And I think you could summarize it like this, that the church was not a perfect patron of science, but it was the only patron of science as we know it. And no other society got to the crown jewel of experiment, because they didn't have that belief in God. Fatalism infects all the religions of the world except Judaism and Christianity. And fatalism gets in the way of many things. The Muslims will never have the same approaches until they change their belief system, because there's that wonderful phrase, inshallah. Allah did it. Why bother? As one of my friends who was involved in setting up a dialysis program in Riyadh said on one occasion, a technician shrugged and said, inshallah, when a dialysis machine stopped. To which, of course, my friend said, it's not Allah, it's a fuse, fix it. And it's a wonder he didn't get lynched, because he could have been, but But it makes the point. And animists, of course, are even more fatalistic than Muslims. What's going to happen is going to happen. When you've seen a nurse pick up a needle off the ground and put it in a vein, you know that despite the exam that she or he may have passed, they didn't understand what it was about. After all, they've never seen a microbe. It's pure faith. There's much more evidence for evil spirits than there is for the microbes in their world, as far as I see it. So we inhabit a long story. And it started going astray during this period I'm talking about, because this is where the four causes were reduced to two. Bacon, both of them were involved. Rogers was a rather arrogant man at Oxford, a Franciscan, who didn't like anybody who thought they were brighter than he was. But Francis Bacon said, collect facts. And in so doing, he changed the meaning of the word fact. Or it was being changed, because before him came Ockham. Now, Ockham was also a Franciscan, and he's at the heart of many of our problems. Very bright man, who was willing to take on the Pope over various issues at various times, but he said he was upset with Aristotelian categories, universals, and he said they get in the way. The only things that we can know, and here's the change in epistemology, are things that we appreciate with the senses or their extension in instruments. Now, he did this to predict God's right, if he wished, to make logically contradictory statements. He was almost a Muslim in his approach to God, if you like. I think most Christians would say there are some things God can't do, and they are those things which contradict his nature. They're logically impossible. So Occam's, you've all heard of Occam's razor, that you shouldn't multiply causes beyond necessity. The only problem with Occam's razor is that it's a simplification which isn't always true. It's an American failure, as your great commentator Mencken used to say. The problem with Americans is they're addicted to simple solutions. The only problem is they don't work. Whether he saw quantum physics coming, I don't know, but it would make sense. Sometimes the truth is more complex than the simplest explanation of the data would suggest. So Ockham was wrong. But it did make all these things possible. It did make the step into reductive thinking, and that word came up, reductionism, in the first lecture too. Reductionism is simply the practice of reducing things to the simplest models. And it's dangerous. Sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not. And as scientists in the Western world, we fall in love with our metaphors. And if it's a simple explanation and it has great power, we will hold on to it much longer than we ought to, because we neglect the data that is outstanding. And we leave it. We pretend it hasn't happened. We've all done it at various times. We do it with diagnosis. We do it in all sorts of areas at various times. We shouldn't. We should look at the world as it is, as far as we're able, and admit that our models don't work. I used to begin my biochemistry lecture, honours lecture, every year with the first lecture, like the lady who spoke this morning at the prayer breakfast. I mean, she was nice. She prayed about people leaving her course who were going to be a pain in the backside. I just got rid of them by asking questions they didn't expect, because they weren't there to learn. They were there to get the highest grade possible to get into medical school or whatever. So one of the three or four things that I did in every opening lecture was to say, atoms don't exist. And of course, they've just spent 4 years of university fees on learning about atoms, so it wasn't exactly an acceptable statement. But what I wanted them to understand, of course, is that atom is a metaphor. The reality is much more complex than the metaphor. Atoms, as Dalton understood them, were the ultimate particles. We've got past that in the 1920s, but it's a useful model. What we do as scientists is we build provisional models to explain the data we've got. None of them last indefinitely, because God has made a more complex world than we are capable of handling, and I suspect it's always going to be like that. So don't fall in love with your metaphors and your models. I don't care which they are. Just stay with the facts. But you see, This word fact is another sticky word. For Newton, the word fact had a different meaning than it does for you and for me. In the introduction to the Principia, Newton says, "I feign no hypotheses," by which he means, I'm only giving you a model, a metaphor for reality. I don't pretend that it's the reality. But of course the Newtonians pretended that it was. It's the same with Calvin and Calvinists, isn't it? You know, it's a common human error. Darwin and Darwinists are another example. You know, they take it further than the master himself would have taken it. And that's a mistake. So, for Newton, facts were the moral facts. And here's another thing that you need to get regularly into your teaching. The way to do it is by asking questions. I went to the session, one of the sessions this morning on academic freedom, but it was legal, it was about the law, and I was more interested in other aspects of it, because in Canada we're in great danger, because we have hate speech laws which could certainly put me in prison, because hate speech is anything said which the person in the minority group takes offence at. Truth is not a defence. And we have some human rights tribunals which are nothing more nor less than kangaroo courts, and fortunately they've gone too far. How many of you have read Mark Steyn, America Alone? You should have done. It's a good read. He's a wonderful journalist. He takes it too far, but it's fine. But he's in court because of it. He will win, I hope, because if not, it's in real trouble. When that bill went through, I wrote to a good friend as a journalist and said, John, what do you think about this? And back came the email within 20 minutes. He said, I expect to see you in the next cell to me. that's what we face. You're more concerned about freedom, and we're concerned with a justice which is not philosophically founded as well as it was 30 years ago. So for Newton, and this is the point you have to make to your students, the real facts were immaterial facts. I don't know if you've noticed this, but if you made a list of all the things that matter to you most, what would be on that list?
Love,
justice, truth, honor, fidelity. Now, what do all those things have in common? No material existence. Does that mean they're not real? Absolutely not. And the one that works with students best, of course, these days is fidelity. Because one of the things that you can say to anybody under the age of 30 is, I know you all hate divorce. And no one will disagree with you. They may say my parents needed to divorce, but if they'd had proper counselling, they wouldn't have got married in the first place because they were incompatible with one another. But that doesn't mean their children enjoyed their divorce. Children come into the world hardwired to expect fidelity from their parents. It's one of the things written in our souls, part of the image of God, I presume. So all the current generation hate divorce. I can get them to ask me to say things which are politically incorrect starting at that point, because I say, if you follow Janet Smith's four rules, she would pay you $1,000 if you ever divorced. And what do you think happens next? The lecture goes completely off track. They will not let you go on until you've talked about the four Janet Smith's four rules for having a marriage that survives. And these are secular kids. So get this distinction between material and immaterial facts right front and center in your mind, and always do it as a question. You need on your fridge before you set out to teach, don't make statements, ask questions about anything that relates to the realities of life. You can make statements about biochemistry or physics or whatever it is that you teach that's politically correct. But in all other areas, don't ask questions or make yourself available for questions. Don't begin your course by saying, I am a Christian. There are some people in the CCLU or the ACLU who go after you for that. You shouldn't have said that in a university setting. But say, are there any things you want to know about me and how I understand the world before we start this lecture series? The students will ask the questions. Then it's okay. So do it that way every time. So in this story, we've got to the point, 100 years after Newton, where Laplace has got to real... he was probably the ultimate reductionist. He believed that we would be able to explain everything. And that you didn't need God. Now, he himself was a practicing Catholic. The incoherence is one of the things that these people live with. This is scientism. The best person I know to deconstruct scientism is Robert Spitzer. If you can find his lecture on scientism, I've listened to it a dozen times at least. I can't match it by any means. He teaches quantum physics and theology, and he's a Jesuit. That's the kind of mind you need for this sort of thing. When he prays, you think you're listening to a Pentecostal until you analyze the vocabulary and realize that is not a viable proposition. An amazing man. He has as his modest lifetime objective to redeem the culture. He's retiring as president of Gonzaga next year because he thinks he's done all that he can there. He's about 40. And he has a life principles program. Robert Spitzer can get people to talk about God without mentioning God himself. And in fact, the whole of his life principles program is how to talk about the things that matter to us in a secular setting without using the name of God. And it works. I do the same using his techniques with some discussion with him over abortion. I give a regular lecture on abortion. And I have yet to have a single aggressive question at the end of the lecture. The key is to turn the whole thing on its head and ask the question, what would you need to believe to be a coherent, logical, and ethical abortionist? And what would you need to believe to hold the opposite position? The difference between the two is not at the level of rationality. Well, it is at the level of rationality. It's not that one is rational and the other is irrational. But in terms of moral rationality, we have no consensus. So both sides need to be represented. And we'll come to that again in a moment as we get a little nearer to Dawkins and what we need to do next. Now, of course, the next major revolution after the Copernican one in science, on the life sciences side, the Greek Copernicus was the physical sciences, but biology followed later, and Darwin was the key move. And Darwin's book is worth reading. It's a stunning piece of rhetoric in many ways. It's not the most logical book that's ever been written, but an incredibly clever book. It spends a long while talking about pigeons to begin with, simply to build the ethos within which his point could be made, and says not one paragraph about human beings in the whole of The Origin of Species. That you get that in The Descent of Man, which most Darwinists don't want you to read, because he is frankly racist. He was a creature of his time, after all. But read The Descent of Man as well as The Origin of Species. They're worth reading. But Darwin comes along and proposes a reductionistic view of the biological world. Explanations purely in terms of things that we could measure. Hopefully. Now, obviously, how that actually turns out, I don't know. And I'm a skeptic by nature. My position is not quite as far as Francis Collins. It's an important question, I know, for you in the US, and so just to demonstrate the technique, I won't answer it. I'll ask you questions. And you might try writing them down, just so that you've got it written down in front of you afterwards. Here's question one, and you can write your own answer down. Do you believe that the Bible is literally true? Now, I'll give you a moment just to write that down. I'll watch a few pens to see when they stop writing, and then I know you've written your answer. It's only yes or no, so to speak, or maybe, or whatever. And the common answer here amongst evangelical groups is yes, I believe it to be literally true. And I say, I don't think so, and I think I can prove it to you. When Jesus says, I am the door, do you look for a handle? And the answer this time is, of course, no. You recognize that that's a metaphor. Now, when Mark in the Gospel says of the feeding of the 5,000, they sat down on the grass and it was green, is that a metaphor? What is it? What does it tell you? Is it theologically important that the grass is green? No. But it tells you something. What does it tell you? It tells you the time of year. And I think it tells you that Mark was there. You imagine yourself in Mark's position, sitting at your table writing, and you sit back saying, I'll write about the feeding of the 5,000. And into his mind's eye, he sees the picture of these Jewish robes against a green background. So he writes, they sat down on the grass and it was green. It's reportage. It tells you that this is an eyewitness account. It happened. So now we have the limits. We go from pure metaphor to pure reporting. Now, here's the next question for you to try on your victims. If I read a story to you that began once upon a time in the land of Uz, what kind of story would that be? Fiction, a fairy tale, right? It's also the opening of the Book of Job in Tolkien's translation. Now, who knows more about the kind of literature that Job is, you or Tolkien? Who had made the greater study of ancient languages? This is a no-brainer, isn't it? Tolkien says this is a kind of narrative that would appropriately begin once upon a time in the land of Uz. Now, in fact, it's very like that even in the more normal translations. It's simply they don't put it at the beginning. Tolkien, to make the point, does. Now, he also goes on in his marvellous essay on fairy tales to point out to you that fairy tales are truer than the newspaper. But this is truth at an entirely different level. And if you're a physician, I don't think you'd have any doubt that if you were covered with boils, the probability that you would sit down on the ground for several days and have a long discussion about the meaning of suffering is minimal. That might happen after the boils are gone, but it wouldn't be happening while the boils are there in the same way. Now, I don't know what the story behind Job is, but I know it's this idea again, isn't it? The purpose of the statue is to beautify it. The question to ask about Job and about Genesis is, what is it for? Ancient people asked of stories not how do they fit together, but what are they for? So how many creation stories are there in Genesis? At least two, yeah. Do they fit together? Not in our sense. The order of creation is different in the two, and in one, male and female are both created from the dust of the earth, and in the second, female is created from Adam's rib. But that would not be a problem either in Africa or, I suspect, in the ancient world. I know several tribes that have more than one creation story that don't fit together, because they ask the ancient question, what is the story for? And it's perfectly obvious to them that the stories don't fit together, but they're there for different purposes. Now, what are the main purposes of the first story in Genesis? If you sort of stand back a little bit and look at the story as a whole, what are its main purposes? In the beginning, God. Even that. You see, that's the key question. In the beginning, what? What does Darwin say? Well, he refuses to engage that issue. He wants to say that God exists, but that's it. The Bible says, in the beginning, God, and everything else comes from him and is under him in that sense. What would you put as the second most important comment in Genesis 1?
Man created God's image.
Yeah. And after the heavens, the only other thing that doesn't get the individual accolade, and it was good. We are different from the animals, not in the material sense, because God has no material existence, but in the immaterial sense. The way I illustrate this nowadays, and it works because the lectures can get a bit heavy and this just lightens it for a moment, but I live on a farm nowadays when I'm not travelling, which is about half the year. And we raise Hereford cattle. And it is Hereford, by the way, not Hereford. There's an E in the middle. I grew up some 25 miles from Hereford, so I do know how to say the word, but I don't expect it to change in America. What it Shaw said, and in America, English entirely disappears. But why shouldn't it? You outnumber us. But anyway... In that farm, my cattle spend most of the year in the same field, which is basically an east-west field. And at the western end of the field, there's a creek and there's a dam just below the field. So there's actually a pond at the end of the field. Now, come October, just before it freezes, the temperature's dropping, but the water hasn't frozen yet. We get spectacular sunsets, purples, greens, indigos, really super colours. And of course, they're reflected in this lake, this pond. And I will put on my coat at 0 centigrade or minus 10 centigrade and go out and watch the sunset. My cows have never joined me. Beauty is entirely gratuitous. It's for us. There's no animal that appreciates beauty as we do. They don't. There are things that Darwinists will point to as indications, perhaps, in that direction. But they're always about sex or getting a mate or something like that. It's not gratuitous as it is for us. That we will stop and just, you know, I can remember the first time I heard the clarinet, Mozart's clarinet quintet. You know, I was just spellbound. It doesn't happen to animals. That's part of the image of God. In fact, my favorite approach with students these days to pre-evangelism is to use Simone Weil's four categories of why believe, because they will relate to it. And I note, interestingly enough, that Tom Wright uses somewhat similar categories, although he doesn't mention Simone Weil. But as you know, she was a Marxist Jewess and a very smart woman indeed, and she became a Christian. And when she became a Christian and was asked why, she had four wonderful reasons. She said, first, the very rare subjective experience of God. Usually two or three times in a lifetime, I would guess, what I'm talking about, the sort of thing that Isaiah had in the temple. Things that are so overwhelming you don't very often discuss them. A couple of times in my life. The second one is much more important. That's meeting people who are holy, usually inversely related to education. That's my gloss. When I was some considerable distance from being an active Christian, when I was living in the Caribbean, in Jamaica, I'd gone to church when children arrived because I wanted to bring them up. We'd gone back to church because we realized we couldn't run our marriage without help, and certainly we couldn't bring up children without help. But the faith never showed up in work at that stage. And so there would be the professor going to a little Brethren chapel, which is the nearest church to the university where a lot of the students went on Sunday morning. And what I really wanted was to hear one illiterate Jamaican pray. There's a lot of extemporary prayers, you probably know, in Brethren services, or semi-extemporary prayer. But this guy, it was extemporary. And it was a privilege to listen, because he was talking to a God he knew. And it was a privilege to be in on the conversation. That's what she's talking about. It's real. And you can, anybody who denies it is just in denial. The third one is beauty, which is gratuitous. And the fourth one is for doctors. The absolute lack of mercy in nature. How can you defend on a Darwinian model the universal desire for mercy that never happens in nature? You know, I watch the cattle. There's no, the little runt, he's going to die if you don't make some effort. They feed according to pecking order, and the weakest come last. That's the animal world in most cases. There are a few exceptions, and then they're only temporary usually. Even in human society without Christianity, I've got many pictures of African women feeding all their children after the men have had the best from a common pot, and the little runt is not getting his share. He's doomed while they feed from a common pot. But we do desire mercy, don't we? It always seems that you have to warn medical students that so often the first patient you see die is, you know, a 15-year-old child is the only child of elderly parents. You know, it always seems to be a disaster. I don't have an answer for those things. There's no immediate answer. The only answer is it's either delayed or it's not. There is no answer to suffering in this current world that you would, with any sensitivity, to propose to somebody going through it. I've spent my life dealing with basically three groups of children, none of whom have a fulfilling life in a reductionistic sense: children with cystic fibrosis, children with cerebral palsy, and 10-pound two-year-olds of the developing world. And now, adding to that, AIDS orphans via my daughter's work in Central Africa. There's no answer to these questions that's satisfying. Within those, you see people who grow dramatically in the process, but it isn't because the problem was answered, it's because God turned up. The comfort was other than philosophical, if you like. So Darwin comes along and proposes his theory, which you'll hear more about, I'm sure, that later this afternoon. And of course, it's very attractive to 19th century industrialists and all the rest. The social setting in which this happened, the survival of the fittest was not Darwin's phrase, it was Spencer's. And of course, Thomas Huxley was particularly tough in this direction. Then you get people like Margaret Sanger coming along later and saying, we shouldn't be saving the genetically impure. And now, of course, we're moving steadily in that direction as the prevalence of cystic fibrosis has diminished by at least 20% in North America since the discovery of the gene. Do you know who discovered it, by the way? Yeah, along with Lap Chee. There's two people involved. I heard Francis Collins give a talk on the Human Genome Project about 4 or 5 years ago in Chicago. And he did not mention his own work. Now, it's very rare that you get a world-class scientist giving a lecture on genetics and not mentioning what he did himself. But he didn't. Now, of course, I was thinking, when's it going to come? And then I realized it wasn't going to come because he was lecturing to the Christian Medical Dental Association. And I've no doubt, I haven't had a chance to talk to him properly, but I only had a chance to ask him a question because he was off to the next meeting immediately afterwards. And I said, what do you think about eugenics? Now, obviously, he'd listened to me, preceded him, and obviously I had an impact on him because we'd never met, but he remembered my name, but maybe he's that kind of guy. And he said, John, I don't know what to say. Here's the director of the Human Genome Project who doesn't know what to say about eugenics, but the one use of his discovery has been to do eugenic abortions. We know exactly what the defect is in cystic fibrosis, and when I last looked, it had made no difference to treatment. It's a tiny little defect on the chloride conductance channel where a gate doesn't work properly. Can't fix it. But we're getting rid of the problem. And we have a list about 20 or 30 long that we intend to get rid of in Canada. I don't know what the HMOs are doing in the USA. That's eugenics. We don't know what else we'll be getting rid of in the process. It would serve us right if we woke up and found the average IQ of the whole population had dropped by 20% as a result of these things. That could easily happen because we've no idea where that comes from. But this is the world that we're moving towards. A reductionistic understanding of who we are, which is what Darwin, taken to the nth degree, would lead towards and will lead to similar ideas in terms of the mind and everything else. We have got to fight very hard for the importance of the immaterial dimensions to our life. You go home to your spouse and say, I'll tolerate a little love tonight, and you won't get too far. It's the wrong verb in the wrong place. We need to talk about these things, and we're not doing a good job. Even, I would put it, and this, with this I'll finish, because I want there to be discussion. This is a Campus Crusade weekend that I'm enjoying a lot. So what I'm about to say is a little critical of Campus Crusade, but please take it in the spirit in which it is given. I think that the model that is used needs a little enrichment and a little nuancing. The four spiritual laws, I don't think, lead us to Christ. I think what they do is they enable people to whom Christ has already come to be able to articulate what has happened. Now, an exercise I would suggest you do when you get to your room at some point is write down your own conversion story. Is it an explanatory story? Can you lift your conversion from yourself and fit it on someone else? Can you do that? You can't, can you? Conversion stories are non-explanatory stories. We shouldn't be surprised because that's exactly what Jesus said. Do you remember the conversation with Nicodemus? Nicodemus, in our terms, was a university prof. And profs recognize talent. And they're always envious. That's what got Galileo into trouble. Sometimes it's very amusing. I'm here today in part because of that phenomenon, because for many years I denied that I had been given any particular gifts by the good Lord. I was smart enough to know that if you claim to be a Christian and have gifts, you have responsibilities. The only way to avoid the responsibility was to deny the gift, to rationalize it in some way or another. And then one of my colleagues said to me one day, how long do you spend preparing undergraduate lectures? And I rather flippantly said, well, 20 minutes is a bit excessive, isn't it? And he said, you're not actually joking, are you? And I said, well, no, I'm not. I hadn't realized that most profs spend hours and hours and hours. I never did a PowerPoint. I thought it was a total waste of my time. My wife does them occasionally. I still don't use them, but at some stage they will happen. I think they disturb concentration primarily. But then that reality turned me around as I began to realize that maybe I should be applying the gifts that I'd been given in other areas. I wish I'd done it years earlier. My life, the happiest summer of my life was 1995, and it was in Central Africa in the refugee camps with the Rwandan refugees from the Rwandan war. My wife worked with them for 2 years because, well, it's a long story, we haven't got time to go into there. So I went out to see my wife in the summer of 95, not having seen her for 6 months, when she came home briefly at Christmas. And I knew that my research in the area was in ruins, so I was going to spend the summer reading and getting to know my wife again. But I got there and she said, no, I have work for you. I have arranged for you to speak with the leaders of a dozen refugee camps tomorrow. She knows I don't suffer from jet lag. If you knew my wife, you'd know that I had no option, and the next day I was talking to the leaders of a bunch of refugee camps. And after about 3 hours, we got to the question, which was brilliant. They said, we want you to help us to understand how we came to kill one another. People had murdered people they'd sat next to in church. Women had murdered children whose names they knew. And when it was all over, they couldn't understand themselves either. Well, God had prepared me, and I said something that I would never normally have said in Africa. I said, there are four talks I think might help you. One was how Britain reconverted in the 5th century. The second was deepening your sense of what salvation is. The third was Christian character, and the fourth was child-rearing for virtue, which is, by the way, what no Hittites on the streets of New York are about. And instead of nailing it down, they said, can we arrange that? I ended up teaching between 3 and 6 hours a day, every other day, for the next 2 months. I was in tears, they were in tears, and that was the happiest summer of my life. The first time in my life that I had said to God, this summer is yours. I'd done Christian things, but I was always in control of the agenda. You probably all know about that. The best time is when you give up the agenda as well. That lovely line from Chariots of Fire, when I run, I feel his pleasure. Well, God made me articulate, and for the first time that summer, I gave the gift back to the giver, and I felt his pleasure. Now, there's no Darwinian explanation of these things. It's a God of the gaps argument, so maybe there will be, but at the moment there isn't. I don't think there will be, personally. And salvation is one of the key areas to talk about, tacit knowledge. Now, if you want to get into the idea of tacit knowledge, read first Drusilla Scott, then Leslie Newbegin, and finally Polanyi, where the idea comes from. But Drusilla Scott writes beautifully, and she had dinner with Polanyi many times, so I think the book is called Every Man Revisited. But Polanyi was a Hungarian Jew, non-practicing, who probably became a Christian, but he never said so. When he was in his 20s, he was already corresponding with Einstein, who replied, that's how good he was. He would have got a Nobel Prize in chemistry, which his son, Michael Polanyi, did get. But the Russian Revolution occurred. And he had an important conversation with Bukharin, the Soviet Minister of Science. And he asked the question, what will Soviet science policy look like? And Bukharin said, the proletariat will tell the scientists what to do. Well, Polanyi knew that was the death of science. You can't tell scientists what to do. Tell technicians what to do. But for 20 years, one protein got me out of bed in the morning. I wouldn't get out of bed for the protein that was being studied in the next lab. Neither would they get out of bed for my protein. I couldn't explain why, neither could they. That's tacit knowledge. It just grabbed me from day one. Polanyi knew that this was so, and he also used to say, to be provocative, you know the results of the experiment first, you do it afterwards. And he's right again. All the most important advances, not P PhD advances, but real advances, are intuitive. Mm-hmm. Einstein famously said, I felt my equations, and then there was a great deal of work to do to find out whether my feelings were right. That's common. If you're lucky, you have the odd experience like that. I've had a couple. Wonderful. But Polanyi ran away, fortunately, from Hungary to Germany, which wasn't a smart move as a Jew, but he ran away from Germany just in time to get away from Hitler, and he ended in Manchester. And then Oxford later, but Manchester was the important point. He was fascinated by what working class men did. See, in both Birmingham, Manchester, and all the industrial area of Britain, the guys had little sheds at the bottom of the garden where they went to get away from the wife and make things. And they made extraordinary things. I had a grandfather who was a Rolls-Royce toolmaker, it was that guy, and uncles too. The bottom of the garden was where they had a good time. And Polanyi was fascinated. But he was fascinated with something you've all met. I hope you've all got hobbies of some sort. Because if you do have a hobby, you can see work in your area and you can rank order it immediately, right? So that's good, that's better, that's not so good. You rationalise afterwards how you did that. You did it instantly. And the best example that Polanyi has is the making of violins. If the university's reductionistic epistemology was right, and it's wrong, you could take a Stradivarius violin to pieces, make exact replicas of every piece using computer-assisted design to nanometer tolerances, and then you'd have two Stradivarii. But you wouldn't. You'd still only have one, and you've got to get it back together again as well. That you can't do it that way. That's why there's no 101 course on how to make violins that's of any value in that sense. Now, if you want to be a violin maker today, you have to find a modern violin maker who's very good. And who will tell you that? Someone like Pinker Zuckerman, who, when listening to violins, can sometimes tell you which Stradivarius is being played. He can hear it. I can't. You probably can't. So you go to such a man and say, sir, I want to be a violin maker. And he says, well, show me some of your work. In most cases, he'll say, don't waste your time. He might say, possibly. So you sweep the floor, make the coffee, watch, and eventually you get to the point where he gives you a valuable piece of alpine pine to cut out. You cut it out, and then he takes it from you, and he feels it. He says, ah, you've taken too much off here. This will never be a great violin. Now, he knows that if a violin is going to sing, it's not about the strings, it's about how it all fits together. It's the wood that makes the tone. He knows whether it's going to work or not. Can he tell you what it is? No. It's the same in surgery. You can go in, and as far as the administrators are concerned, a cholecystectomy is a cholecystectomy. They all have the same price tag attached. If you ask any physician, and he'll tell you, I'm not having a cholecystectomy done by him, but I will have it done by him. They're not all the same, because the difference can't be measured. One guy has a feel for tissues, there's no blood loss. The other guy's a butcher. But you can't, you can rationalize there's blood loss, there isn't, but you knew that before. You just have to watch him if you know what's about. Even at the level of a physicianly interaction with patients, much less so now because we're being turned into technicians, but I remember the first time it happened to me, a guy came into outpatients in London, and I knew the diagnosis before he said a word. I couldn't work out how I'd done it, because I then asked all the questions, did the test, and I was right. He got angina. Now, I realised he was an inarticulate sort of man. He came in and I said, what's your problem? And he couldn't find the word he wanted, and I had seen his hands clenching and unclenching. And I obviously had done the analysis. He's trying to find the word tight, constricting, and he doesn't have the vocabulary. That's exactly how it feels when you've got angina. If they say I've got a pain here, you know that's not a problem, but they talk about this and you know they have. So I got there. It's a very simple example. One you can all know. You could all tell me how to recognise your spouse or your parents or your children. But would it be the way you do it? No, it wouldn't. You do it instantly and nobody knows how you do it. You can rationalise afterwards. We need to make that distinction. We need to introduce our students to that level of sophisticated epistemology. Conversion is a very, very good example. They don't explain. They tell what was happening, how you felt. Let me just, to finish, 1 minute, read one of my favourite examples of this. It's William Cowper's conversion. William Cowper is the poet who wrote the hymn, God Moves in a Mysterious Way, His Wonders to Perform. one you know. He was also afflicted with depression all his life, despite the fact that he had, what's his name, of Amazing Grace as his pastor. His name I've forgotten at the moment. John Newton, thank you. But this is what William Cooper wrote. And it's not the four spiritual laws. I'm not saying they're wrong. Jesus says to Nicodemus, unless you're born of the Spirit, you cannot comprehend. That's not the four spiritual laws. The enemy's actually got a bit of an outpost in your head, because you're agreeing to present conversion in the terms which the modern society wishes. It's propositional, which is what they want. Shouldn't go there. Jesus would never do that. Now, it does help, as I've said, but stick to the real thing. This is Cooper. He describes how he was under conviction of sin and in agony of soul. He could find no peace. He was walking back and forth in his room, almost at the point of despair, feeling utterly hopeless, not knowing what to do with himself. Suddenly, in sheer desperation, he sat down on a chair by the window. There was a Bible there, so he picked it up and opened it, and he happened to come to Romans 3. He wrote, "The passage which met my eye was the 25th verse of the 3rd chapter of Romans. On reading it, I received immediate power to believe. The rays of the Sun of Righteousness fell on me in all their fullness. I saw the complete sufficiency of the expiation which Christ had wrought for my pardon and entire justification. In an instant I believed and received the peace of the gospel. If the arm of Almighty God had not supported me, I believe I should have been overwhelmed with gratitude and joy. My eyes filled with tears. Transports choked my utterances. I could only look to heaven in silent fear, overflowing with love and wonder." We have to reintroduce to our world at least two epistemologies, and they're both valid. I practice reductionistic science, which was tacitly atheistic. I call it an atheistic fiction. I practice science to find out how much of God's world I could understand without invoking God as the explanation. I think that's the right way to do science. It doesn't mean I believe there is no God, far from it. But these things, they are real, and they can be explained, in my view, in no other way. Thank you. Now, I don't know, the questions, there were a lot of, as my wife would tell me, far too many rabbit trails that left you dangling at one point or another. That's part of the deal. Dennis, bring me back to...
Just a comment, I think we're on the same page. The fairs say that when we come to our evangelical apologetics today that, in effect, we are crypto positivists in many ways.
Yes. Now, you better unpack that for the benefit of everybody else. I mean, positivism, yes.
But positivism is basic. Well, scientism and
positivism are very similar.
Obviously, Christians are not positivists.
No.
Scientists. But we've been very enamored by the method, and we want to shape our epistemology in light of the academy.
Yeah.
Now, there's a side that we come down
even to within the church.
Oh, it's within it.
That's where the problem lies, yeah. Yeah. I agree entirely. And we need to be up front and centre about the fact that, as Jesus said, I'll tell you what happened to me and you can't understand. Now, my favourite verse for getting students to move on is, in fact, John 7:17. I find students, of course, they have opinions about the Bible having never read it. And I say, if you came to my class with an opinion about a paper you hadn't read and I trashed you, would you have any grounds for complaint? And the answer is no. And I say, well, I won't trash you now, but here, I know you're lazy. Just read the first 7 chapters of John's Gospel before you have another opinion about the Bible. And when you get to verse 17 of chapter 7, by that stage, Jesus is saying, in effect, through John, I know this is a problem for you. He said that to Jews, unless you drink my blood, you're no part of me. He said, I'm the light of the world. He said, I came to save your sins. This is all a bit much to take. But in verse 17, Jesus in effect says, you want to know whether this is all true? The only way you can find out is by doing the experiment. Live as though it is, and you will find that it is. Very, very dangerous experiment to do, but only somebody who's intellectually dishonest would refuse to do it. Yes. Any other comments, questions? Yes. Oh, Christian is the one that I would use, and we have lots of space for this now. Medicine is leading the way, fortunately, because the liberals have made a couple of very bad mistakes. The first is that they have said that medicine should be patient-centered, and just recently they compounded their problem by saying that doctors must be culturally competent. Now, I can drive a bus through that hole. And the best way to do it has been done by a very good friend of mine at McGill. He heard me give this sort of talk, and he's a practical internist, a very good guy. And he turned it into practicalities instantly. He did something quite remarkable. He volunteered to teach the Introduction to Clinical Skills course, which nobody in their right mind volunteers to do, because you're telling students that they can hear sounds that are separated by 0.02 of a second, and they don't think you can do that. But in order to get out of the course, they'll say they can hear it. With training, you can do it. But so it's really a course in applied hypocrisy. They say, yes, I can feel that spleen when they can't, etc., etc. But mission accomplished, at least they know there's something like that out there. But he did it because he saw another opportunity. And what he did was brilliant. The first thing he did was he got the students in McGill to identify their own belief system. Now, McGill, Montreal, is probably the most cosmopolitan city in North America. And so the class had all the world's religions represented, including Zoroastrians, you know, because immigrants have more drive. They're overrepresented in medical school. And so he's got a nice histogram of the world's religions and their prevalence in his class. And then he takes the Canadian data, which is government data. We collect data on belief every 10 years and puts it up alongside the data in the class. And there's a huge mismatch. Because in the world's most multicultural nation, which is Canada, on a population basis, far more multicultural than the US, the data is amazing. The Liberals wanted it collected. They wanted ethnicity, but fortunately StatsCan is a good organisation. They said ethnicity is a waste of time. You can't really do it. And if your government ever starts trying to collect ethnicity data, wreck it by saying, you know, I'm 5% this, 6% that, 7% that. You know, it's we're all mongrels, basically. Some are Asian mongrels, some are black mongrels, some are white mongrels, but basically we're all mongrels. It's not the way to go. And it's getting mixed up more every day. But belief, you can do. So that's what they did. Now, being a good organisation, if you got fingered for that subset, they sent you all the world's known religions. And what they did was they filled it in backwards, Canadians. They found out what they were by knowing what they were not. I'm not a Zoroastrian. Don't know what it is. I'm not a Satanist. I'm not a nothing. Not an atheist or agnostic. And I'm not actually a Jew, a Muslim, a Hindu, or a Buddhist. Oh dear, I must be Christian. And Canada is a nation of, oh dear, I must be Christian people. They don't go to church that much, about 20%, and they're not proud of the fact. But insofar as they have any means of handling death and suffering, they're Judeo-Christian ideas. They're not Muslim, they're not animist, they're not secular. And in the end, out of the 30 million Canadians, we have a stable population up there because our immigration rate and our abortion rate match. So we're changing the population without changing the number of people in the country, which is frightening. And in the end, out of the 30 million, almost 14 million decided they were Catholic. Almost 10 million decided they were Protestant. Your ratio would be reversed in a bit more. What do you think the third biggest religion is in both Canada, the US, and I believe certainly Britain?
Muslim.
No, it's way down the list. The third one is nothingness, no known beliefs. I call it Seinfeldism. That's a show about nothing in which nothing has consequences and nothing ever happens. The banal way of the American life. And it's throughout Europe as well. So nothingness was about 3.5 million at that stage. That was 1991. No other group then exceeded 400,000. And David looks at the two sets of data and says to the students, is there a mismatch? And they're honest. Yes, there is. He said, I've arranged to help you. Because your patients are going to be in these two groups, aren't they? But he'd gone round his colleagues. He found a Greek Orthodox physician a Catholic, a liberal Protestant, an evangelical Protestant, a Jew, a Muslim, and a Hindu, couldn't actually find a Buddhist. And he got them to bring their priest, rabbi, imam, pastor. And so the students rotated around these pairings of pastor and physician that afternoon, and they discussed with each ethnic group, each belief group, how our people understand what it is to die and suffer well. It was by far and away the most popular event in the whole of the introductory course to clinical medicine. David himself actually cheated a little bit. He took his pastor's wife with him. Didn't tell them that. And she was an oncology nurse. And she told the story of a woman who was going to die in the next 6 months, who had two children under the age of 10. And how are you going to help this woman cope with that experience? And when she'd finished this third person description, she said, "I'm that woman." And the class all burst into tears. They didn't go to the next class. And they said, "Why don't we have more things like this?" It's open season for us, because meaning is up for grabs, and we have it and they don't. The big problem with Darwinism is it gives you no meaning. It does not tell you why you should do good things. Altruism is the big problem. If you need a book on that, read David Stove from Australia, an atheistic philosopher who will have no truck with the philosophical incoherence of Darwinism over altruism. He's Australia's best philosopher over the last 25 years. He actually committed suicide when he found he got cancer. But the book called Darwinian Fairy Tales is an absolutely superb piece of philosophical writing. And of course, he's not alone. Nagel, Midgley, Anthony Flew, you name it. They're all trashing Dawkins' philosophy. He's good on biology. He should stick there. He's absolutely useless on philosophy. The problem is that he gets the top of the New York bestsellers list, along with Hitchens and Dennett and Harris and all the rest. But we need to learn to trash them at that level, the philosophical level. And the David Stove book, Darwinian Fairy Tales, required summer reading. Yep. Sorry? S-T-O-V-E, just like the oven, you know. Oh, by the way, can I make one other quick bid, because I probably won't have a chance any time else this weekend. I teach the history of ideas now because about 15 years ago, six professors in the University of Ottawa were brought together by Providence, I believe. We'd all got to the same stage of seeing our students forgetting what the university was about, truth, and actually coming only to get pieces of paper to live at the weekend. It was not satisfying. And we began by having a reading group to read about everything good that had been written about the nature of education. Our most hated faculty was the Faculty of Education, because we hold them responsible for wrecking the system, because they presume to teach something which is the conjunction of two passions, and you can't teach passion. And we decided at the end that the way to protect our young people from this disaster was not a Bible school, but the history of ideas. And we began teaching the history of science, medicine and mathematics, art and architecture, literature and philosophy, Latin and the history of the church and theology in 8 months. This guy had one of his friends come from the University of Texas Medical School, Southwestern. We've had two medical students this last year take a year off to do this. Evangelical students going to university have an 80% probability of losing their faith. They take this course, we reverse those figures. 80% will come out with a flourishing faith. So if you know bright kids, come and get one of these and encourage your church. The other thing, if any of you are musicians, it's a fundraiser for the college, this is a blunt, I'm abusing Campus Crusade, but this is a brilliant DVD set. It's Jeremy Begbie, who teaches theology through the arts in Cambridge and Edinburgh. And he teaches you how to think about music Christianly. He plays a little bit of Mozart near the beginning and stops one chord before the end and says, all of you can hear that there's another chord to come. Mozart, if he was asleep two floors up, would wake up, come down, play the last chord. Then he could go back to sleep again. And he points out that music in the Western tradition is a home, away, and home again story. Home key, away, back again. 3 hours in a Wagner opera. But then postmodernity did not begin with 20th century French philosophers. It began with Chopin in the 19th century, who asked the question, why should music resolve? And he wrote some that didn't. That's where postmodernity began, in Begbie's view. And he takes you through music and helps you to understand why the young and the old can't agree about music in church. Begbie, I have a few of these. They're fundraisers, so I need at least $20 from you. There's 3 hours material here. So any of you who want one, I have enough. Come and see me. Thanks.